Chapter 7. The Horror Movie as Junk Food. By now, serious horror fans may be wondering uneasily if I have lost my wits, always assuming I had any to begin with. I have found a few, very few it's true, but still a few, good things to say about the Amityville Horror, and have even mentioned Prophecy, generally agreed to be a terrible horror movie, in a light not exactly unfavorable. If you are one of these uneasy ones, I must add to your feelings by telling you that I intend to say a great many good things about the Englishman James Herbert, author of The Rat, The Fog, and The Survivor in a later chapter, but that is a different case because Herbert is not a bad novelist. He is simply regarded as one by fantasy fans who have not read his work. I am no apologist for bad filmmaking, but once you've spent 20 years or so going to horror movies, searching for diamonds or diamond chips in the dreck of the B-picks, you realize that if you don't keep your sense of humor, you're done for. You also begin to seek the patterns and appreciate them when you find them. There's something else that needs saying here, too, and I might as well give it to you straight from the shoulder. Once you've seen enough horror films, you begin to get a taste for really shitty movies. Films that are just bad, like The Comeback, Jack Jones's ill-advised foray into the field of the horror film, can be dismissed impatiently with never a backward glance. But real fans of the genre look back on a film like The Brain from Planet Arras.
It came from another world with uninsatiable lust for Earth women.
With something like real love. It is the love one spares for an idiot child, true, but love is love, right?
Right.
In this spirit, let me quote, in its marvelous entirety, a review from The Castle of Frankenstein's TV Movie Guide. The movie guide was published in the magazine at irregular intervals, right up until the day when Kelvin Beck's remarkable journal ceased publication. This review is, in fact, from the movie guide which appeared in the last issue of CFF, number 24. Here is what an uncredited reviewer, Beck himself perhaps, had to say about the 1953 movie Robot Monster. It is a handful of flicks like this that makes all these listing chores, i.e. the movie guide feature, something to look forward to. Certainly among the finest terrible movies ever made, this ridiculous gem presents as economical a space invasion as ever committed to film. One Roman invader, consisting of A. a gorilla suit, B. a diving helmet with a set of antennae. Hiding out in one of the more familiar Hollywood caves with his extraterrestrial bubble machine. No, we're not being facetious. It actually is a two-way alien radio TV thing, consisting of an old war surplus shortwave set resting on a small kitchen table that emits Lawrence Welk-like bubbles. Roman's trying to wipe out the last six humans left on Earth and thus make the planet safe for colonization by Roman from the planet Roman. Where else? This early 3D effort has attained legendary and richly deserved status as one of the most laughable of all Poverty Row quickies, although the pic does make some scatterbrained sense when viewed as a child's eye monster fantasy. It's all a dream experienced by a sci-fi crazed 50s tyke. Rousing musical score by Elmer Bernstein is great and keeps it all moving. Directed in three frenzied days by Phil Tucker, who also did the little-known and equally hysterical Lenny Bruce vehicle, Dance Hall Racket. Stars George Nader, Claudia Barrett, John Mylon, Selena Royal. Ah, Selena, where are you now? I have seen the film discussed in this review, and will personally testify that every word is true. A bit further on in this chapter, we will listen to what C of F had to say about two other legendary bad movies, The Blob and Invasion of the Saucer Men, but I don't believe my heart can stand it right now. Let me just add that I made a grave mistake concerning Robot Monster, and Roman can be seen in a mad sort of way as the forerunner of the evil Cylons in Battlestar Galactica about 10 years ago. It came on the Saturday Night Creature feature, and I prepared for the occasion by smoking some pretty good reefer. I don't smoke dope often because when stoned, everything strikes me funny. That night, I almost laughed myself into a hernia. Tears were rolling down my cheeks, and I was literally on the floor for most of the movie. Luckily, the movie only runs 63 minutes. another 20 minutes of watching Roman tune his war surplus shortwave bubble machine in one of the more familiar Hollywood caves, and I think I would have laughed myself to death. Since any affectionate discussion of really horrible movies, as opposed to horror movies, is in the nature of a breast-bearing, I must admit here that I not only liked John Frankenheimer's Prophecy, I actually saw it 3 times. The only bad movie to equal this score in my personal pantheon is the William Friedkin movie Sorcerer. I liked that one because there were a lot of close-ups in it of sweaty people working hard and laboring machines, truck engines and huge wheels spinning in soupy mud and frayed fan belts on the giant screen. Great stuff! I thought Sorcerer was marvelous fun. I wasn't able to have any fun with Friedkin's more recent film, Cruising, although it fascinated me because I suspect it indicates the wave of the future for the bad film which has a big budget. It has a sparkly look that is still somehow cheesy. It's like a dead rat in a lucite block. But never mind Friedkin. Onward into the Maine woods with John Frankenheimer. Except that the film was really shot on location in Washington State, and looks it. This film concerns a public health officer, Robert Foxworth, and his wife, Talia Shire, who come to Maine to investigate possible water pollution infractions on the part of a paper mill. The movie is apparently supposed to be set somewhere in northern Maine, perhaps in the Allegash, but David Seltzer's screenplay has somehow transferred an entire southern Maine county 150 miles north. Just another example of the magic of Hollywood, I guess. In the TV version of Salem's Lot, Paul Monash's screenplay has the little town of Salem's Lot located on the outskirts of Portland, but the young lovers, Ben and Susan, blithely go off to the movies in Bangor at one point. A 3-hour drive. Hi-ho! Foxworth is a figure that any dedicated horror movie buff has seen 100 times before. The dedicated young scientist with just a touch of gray in his hair. His wife wants a baby, but Foxworth refuses to bring a kid into a world where rats sometimes eat babies, and the technological society keeps dumping radioactive waste into the oceans. He jumps at the trip to Maine to get away from patching up rat bites for a while. His wife jumps at it because she's pregnant and wants to break it to him gently. As dedicated to the idea of zero population growth as he may be, Foxworth has apparently left all the responsibility for actually preventing the baby to his wife, who, played by Ms. Shire, succeeds in looking extremely tired throughout the film. We can readily believe she may be whoopsing her cookies every morning. But once in Maine, this slightly odd couple finds a lot of other stuff going on as well. The Indians and the paper company are at swords points over the alleged pollution issue. Early on, one of the company men nearly opens up the leader of the Indian protesters with a steel chainsaw. Nasty. Nastier still are the evidences of pollution. Foxworth notices that the old Indian Walla, one dares not call him chief, is regularly burning his hands with his cigarettes because he feels no pain. A classic sign of mercury poisoning, Foxworth tells Shire gravely. A tadpole the size of a salmon jumps up on the bank of the lake, and while fishing, Foxworth sees a salmon roughly the size of Flipper. Unfortunately for his pregnant wife, Foxworth catches some fish and they eat them. Very bad for the baby, as it turns out, although the question of exactly what Ms. Shire may deliver a few months down the road is left to our imaginations. By the time we finish the movie, the question seems less than burning. Mutated babies are discovered in a net placed in a stream. Horrible, rugose things with black eyes and malformed bodies, things that mewl and cry in almost human voices. These children are the movie's one startling effect. Mother is out there someplace, and she makes her appearance soon enough, looking sort of like a skinned pig and sort of like a bear turned inside out. It pursues Foxworth, Shire, and the motley band they are a part of. A helicopter pilot has his head crunched off, but it is a discreet crunch. This is a PG movie, and the bad old executive who is told lies at every turn is similarly gobbled up. At one point, the monster mother wades across a lake that looks like it might be a child's wading pool shot from tabletop level, bringing back fond memories of such Japanese triumphs of special effects technology as Ghidra, the three-headed monster, and Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster, and crashes its way into a cabin where the dwindling band of refugees has taken refuge. Although he is presented to us as a city boy from the word go, Foxworth manages to dispatch the monster with a bow and arrow. And as Foxworth and Shire fly out of the wilderness, another monster rears its shaggy head to stare after their departing light plane. George Romero's film Dawn of the Dead came out at about the same time as Prophecy, June-July 1979, and I found it remarkable and amusing that Romero had made a horror film for about $2 million that managed to look like $6 million, while Frankenheimer made a $12 million movie that managed to look like about $2. Lots of stuff is wrong with the Frankenheimer film. None of the major Indian parts are played by real Indians. The old Indian Walla has a teepee in a northern New England area which was populated by lodge-building Indians. The science, while not completely wrong, is used in an opportunistic way that is not really fair considering the fact that the movie's makers purported to have made a movie of social conscience. The characters are stock. The special effects, with the exception of those weird baby mutants, are bad. All of that I will cheerfully agree to, but I come stubbornly, helplessly back to the fact that I liked Prophecy, and just writing about it has made me long to rush out and see it a fourth and maybe a fifth time. I mentioned that you begin to see and appreciate patterns in horror movies and to love them. These patterns are sometimes as stylized as the movements in a Japanese no play or the passages in a John Ford Western. And Prophecy is a throwback to the 50s horror films as surely as the Sex Pistols and the Ramones are throwbacks to the Dirty White Boys of the Rockabilly Explosion in 1956 through 1959. For me, settling into Prophecy is as comfortable as settling into an old easy chair and visiting with good friends. All the components are there. Robert Foxworth could as easily be Hugh Marlowe from Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, or Richard Carlson in It Came from Outer Space, or Richard Denning in The Black Scorpion. Talia Shire could as easily be Barbara Rush or Mara Corday, or one of half a dozen other monster movie heroines from that same Big Bug era. Although I would be lying if I didn't admit to some disappointment in Ms. Shire, who was brilliant as Rocky Balboa's shy and hesitant Amor Adrian. She's not as pretty as I remember Mara Corday being, and she never appears in a white one-piece swimsuit, when everyone knows that this particular type of horror movie demands that at one point the heroine must appear and be menaced while wearing a white one-piece swimsuit. The monster is pretty hokey-looking, too. But I love that old monster, spiritual sister to Godzilla, Mighty Joe Young, Gorgo, and all the dinosaurs that were ever embedded in ice floes and managed to get out so they could go thundering slowly down Fifth Avenue, squashing electronics shops and eating policemen. The monster in Prophecy gave me back a splendid part of my misspent youth, a part which included such irascible friends as the Venusian Emir and the Deadly Mantis, who knocks over a city bus on which, for one splendid moment, the word Tonka can be clearly read. She's a pretty fine monster all the same. The mercury pollution causing all those monsters is pretty good, too. An updating of the old radiation-caused-these-big-bugs plot device. Then there's the fact that the monster gets all the bad guys. At one point, she kills a little kid, but the kid, who is on a hiking trip with his parents, really deserves to go. He has brought along his suitcase radio and is defiling the wilderness with rock and roll. All that is missing from Prophecy, and its omission may have only been an oversight, is a sequence where the monster stomps the rotten old paper mill flat. The giant spider invasion also comes equipped with a plot straight out of the 50s, and there were even a lot of 50s actors and actresses on view in it, including Barbara Hale and Steve Brody. Halfway through it, I had the feeling that what I had really stumbled on was a crazed episode of the old Perry Mason series. In spite of the title, there is really only one giant spider. But we don't feel cheated, because it's a dilly. It appears to be a Volkswagen covered with half a dozen bearskin rugs. Four spider legs, operated by people crammed inside this VW spider, one assumes, have been attached to each side. The taillights double neatly as blinking red spider eyes. It is impossible to see such a budget-conscious special effect without feeling a wave of admiration. Other bad movies abound. Each fan has his or her favorite. Who could forget the large canvas bag that was supposed to be Kaltiki, the immortal monster, in the 1959 Italian movie? Or the Japanese version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Monster? Other favorites of mine include the flaming Winston cigarette filter that was supposed to be a crash-landing alien spaceship in Teenage Monster, and Allison Hayes as a refugee from a pro basketball team in The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. If only she could have wandered across into Burt I. Gordon's The Amazing Colossal Man. Think of the children if they had clicked. Then there was the wonderful moment in the 1978 film Ruby, a routine terror job about a haunted drive-in when one of the characters punches a button on the Coke machine and gets a cup of blood. Inside the machine, you see, all of the tubes have been hooked up to a still-warm human corpse. In Children of Cain, a Western horror picture, almost but not quite up to the level of Billy the Kid Meets Dracula, John Carradine goes west with barrels of salt water instead of fresh strapped to the sides of his Conestoga wagon. All the better to preserve his collection of severed heads. Maybe because the historical period would have made the Coke machine an anachronism. In one of those Lost Continent-type pictures, this one starring Cesar Romero, all the dinosaurs were cartoons. Nor should we forget Irwin Allen's The Swarm, with its unbelievable matte jobs and its cast of familiar faces. Here is a picture that manages to even better prophecies time. It is a $12 million picture that manages to look like a $1.98. 2. From Castle of Frankenstein, The Blob. This SF horror comes out as a slightly flat imitation of both Rebel Without a Cause and The Creeping Unknown. Oozing out-of-space horror consumes humans until destroyed in ridiculous ending. This uncharacteristically out-of-patience review of a film which was the first starring vehicle for an actor who then billed himself as Stephen McQueen ignores several fine touches. The theme song, for instance, by a group that sounds suspiciously like the Chords doing outtakes from Shaboom, is played over a happy little cartoon of expanding blobs. The tune, if you care, was written by a kid named Burt Bacharach. The real blob, which arrives on Earth inside a hollow meteor, looks at first like a melted blueberry popsicle and later quite a bit like a giant jujube. In spite of this unpromising start, the film has its genuine moments of unease and horror. The blob smoothly engulfs the arm of a farmer who has been unwise enough to touch it and then turns a sinister red as the farmer screams in agony. Later, after McQueen and his girlfriend discover the farmer and take him to the local doctor, the blob devours first the nurse and then the doctor himself in the shadowy office. Michael J. Rohde, who brought the exact sequence to my attention in a letter following the hardcover edition of this book, which means, dear friends, that I got it wrong the first time, adds that McQueen and his girlfriend return just in time to witness the doctor clawing at his Venetian blinds before being consumed. Also, the C of F review is uncharacteristically wrong about the film's conclusion. The blob proved immortal. It was frozen and flown up to the Arctic to await the sequel, Beware the Blob, also released as Son of the Blob. Perhaps the film's finest moment for those of us who consider ourselves connoisseurs of bad special effects comes when the blob swallows a small diner whole. We see the blob oozing slowly across a color photograph of the diner's interior. Admirable. Must have made Bird Eye Gordon envious. Concerning Invasion of the Saucer Men, a 1957 American international picture, C of F regained some of its more customary savoir-faire. Ludicrous SF quickie, on lowest teenage level. Space invaders are cute little saucer men who inject alcohol into victims' veins. The ending is quite funny. Invasion of the Saucer Men comes from AIP's Brass Age. It really can't be called AIP's Golden Age. That came later, during the spate of films loosely based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe. Most of those were pretty stupid, wandering far afield from the source material, but at least they were pretty to look at. The picture was shot in 7 days, and in the conclusion, The heroic teenagers used their hot red headlights to light the monsters to death. Wasn't Elijah Cook Jr. killed in the first reel, as he was so often? And Nick Adams can be seen in the background wearing his hat backwards. What a crazy kid, right? The monsters are like all wasted, so let's go down to the malt shop, Daddy-O. In a later example of AIP low-budget mania, Invasion of the Star Creatures, 1962, a group of army men stranded in the trackless desert encounter a group of female invaders from space. All of these female invaders have beehive hairdos and look like Jacqueline Kennedy. Much is made of the fact that these fellows are totally cut off from the outside world and must deal with the problem themselves. But there are jeep tracks all over the place, not to mention a lot of foam rocks and, in several scenes, the shadow of the boom mic used to record the sound. One suspects that the film's utterly sleazy look may have come about because the producers overspent on star power. The cast list included such well-loved lights of the American cinema as Bob Ball, Frankie Ray, and Gloria Victor. CFF had this to say about I Married a Monster from Outer Space, a 1958 Paramount release which formed the lower half of Summer Shocker double bills, along with either The Blob or the hilarious Pat Boone film Journey to the Center of the Earth. Kitty-oriented SF programmer, Gloria Talbot marries a monster from outer space which is disguised to look like Tom Tryon. Good argument against hasty marriages, but not much of a movie. Still, this one was a lot of fun, if only for the once-in-a-lifetime chance it offered to see Tom Tryon with a snout. And before leaving this one and proceeding on to what, sadly, may be the worst of the grade Z movies, I'd like to say something a little more serious about the peculiar relationship which obtains between terrible horror movies, of which there are a dozen for each good one, as this chapter testifies, and the genuine fan of the genre. The relationship is not entirely masochistic, as the foregoing may make it seem. A film like Alien or Jaws is for either the true fan or simply the ordinary moviegoer who has a sometime interest in the macabre, like a wide, deep vein of gold that doesn't even have to be mined. It can simply be dug out of the hillside. But that isn't mining, remember. It's just digging. The true horror film aficionado is more like a prospector with his panning equipment or his wash wheel, spending long periods going patiently through common dirt, looking for the bright blink of gold dust or possibly even a small nugget or two. Such a working miner is not looking for the big strike, which may come tomorrow or the day after or never. He has put those illusions behind him. He is only looking for a living wage, something to keep him going yet a while longer. As a result, horror movie fans communicate their likes to each other by a kind of grapevine, which is part word of mouth, part fanzine reviews, part convention hall chatter at such meetings as the World Fantasy Convention, the Kublai Khan 8, or the IguanaCon. Word gets around. Long before David Cronenberg made something of a splash with Rabid, fans were muttering that he was someone to watch on the basis of an earlier film, an extremely low-budget flick called They Came From Within, starring X-rated Queen Marilyn, behind the green door, Chambers. And Cronenberg got a bravura performance out of her, by the way. My agent, Kirby McCauley, raves about a small picture called Ritual, filmed in Canada and starring Hal Holbrook. These films don't get wide American release, but if you watch the papers faithfully, you may see one of them playing at the drive-in as a pickup second feature below some overrated major studio flick. Similarly, I heard about a little-known early John Carpenter film called Assault on Precinct 13 from Peter Straub, the author of Ghost Story and If You Could See Me Now. Done on a shoestring, and Carpenter's first feature, Dark Star, is reputed to have cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000, a sum that makes even George Romero look like Dino De Laurentiis, Carpenter's talent as a director nonetheless shines through, and Carpenter went on to do Halloween and The Fog. These are the nuggets, the horror film fans' reward for sifting through films like Planet of the Vampires and The Monster from Green Hell. My own discovery, if you don't object to the word, is a little film called Tourist Trap, starring Chuck Connors. Connors himself isn't very good in the film. He tries gamely, but he's simply miscast. yet the film wields an eerie, spooky power. Wax figures begin to move and come to life in a ruined, out-of-the-way tourist resort. There are a number of effective atmospheric shots of the dummy's blank eyes and reaching hands, and the special effects are effective. As a film that deals with the queer power that inanimate dummies, mannequins, and human replicas can sometimes cast over us, it is a more effective film than the expensive and ill-advised film made from William Goldman's bestseller, Magic. Home Box Office, in its endless quest for primetime filler, is now making many of these little films available in a way that such spotty distributors as New World Pictures have never been able to do. Of course, there's no shortage of dreck on HBO either, as any subscriber will tell you. Still, there is an occasional prize in the pay TV box, which is usually full of such moldy cinematic crackerjacks as Guyana, Cult of the Damned, and Moment by Moment. In the last year or so, HBO has offered Cronenberg's The Brood and an interesting AIP picture called The Evictors, starring Vic Morrow and Michael Parks, which got no American theatrical distribution, and Tourist Trap. But to get back to I Married a Monster from Outer Space, bad as it is, there is one absolutely chilling moment in the movie. I won't say that it's worth the price of admission, but it works. Boy, does it work. Tryon has married his girlfriend, Gloria Talbot, and they are on their honeymoon. While she stretches out on the bed, dressed in the obligatory filmy white nightgown and waiting for the consummation of all those steamy clinches on the beach, Tryon, who is still a good-looking man and who was even better-looking 20 years ago, goes out on the balcony of their hotel room for a cigarette. A thunderstorm is brewing, and a sharp stroke of lightning abruptly renders that handsome face transparent for a moment. We see the horrible alien face beneath, runneled and knotted and warty. It is a seat jumper for sure, and during the fade-out, we perhaps have time to think about the consummation to follow, and gulp. If movies such as Tourist Trap and Rituals are the nuggets fans sometimes find by sticking around for the B-picture, and no one is so optimistic as the dyed-in-the-wool fan, a moment such as this one is the equivalent of the gold dust that can sometimes be panned out by the faithful toiler. Or to put it another way, there is that marvelous Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, where the Christmas goose, when slit open, yields up the beautiful and priceless stone that has been lodged in its gullet. You sit through a lot of schlock, and maybe, just maybe, there is that frisson that makes it at least partially worthwhile. There is no such frisson in Plan 9 from Outer Space, unfortunately, to which I reluctantly award the booby prize as the worst horror film ever made. Yet there is nothing funny about this one, no matter how many times it has been laughed at in those mostly witless compendiums which celebrate the worst of everything. There's nothing funny about watching Bela Lugosi, actually a stand-in was used for most shots, racked with pain, a morphine monkey on his back, creeping around a Southern California development with his Dracula cape pulled up over his nose. Lugosi died shortly after this abysmal, exploitative, misbegotten piece of trash was released. And I've always wondered in my heart if maybe poor old Bela didn't die as much of shame as of the many illnesses that were overwhelming him. It was a sad and squalid coda to a great career. Lugosi was buried, at his own request, in his Dracula cape. And one likes to think, or hope, that it served him better in death than it did in the miserable waste of celluloid that marked his last screen appearance. 3. Before we move on to horror on TV, where failures in the genre have been every bit as common, but somehow less spectacular, it seems appropriate to finish here by asking a question. Why have there been so many bad horror movies? Before trying to answer that, let's be honest and say that a great many movies are very bad. Not all the turkeys are gobbling in the horror pen, if you take my meaning. Consider Myra Breckinridge, Valley of the Dolls, The Adventurers, and Bloodline, to mention just a few. Even Alfred Hitchcock produced one of those Thanksgiving birds, and unfortunately it was his last picture, Family Plot, with Bruce Dern and Karen Black. and these pictures only scratched the surface of a list that could continue on for 100 pages or more. Probably more. There's an impulse to say something's wrong here. There may well be. If another business, United Airlines, let us say, or IBM, ran their affairs the way 20th Century Fox ran the making of Cleopatra, their boards of directors would soon be down at the local 7-Eleven store buying pizza mix with food stamps. Or maybe the stockholders would just break down the door and wheel in the guillotine. It seems almost incredible to believe that any major studio could even approach the brink of bankruptcy in a country that loves the movies as much as this one does. One might as well try to imagine, you might think, Caesar's Palace or the Dunes wiped out by a single crapshooter. But in fact, there is not one major American film studio which has not at least once, during the 30-year period under discussion here, tottered on the brink. MGM is perhaps the most infamous case, and for a period of 7 years, the MGM lion ceased to roar almost entirely. Perhaps significantly, during this period when MGM was leaving the unreal world of the movies and pinning its hopes for corporate survival upon the unreal gambling world, the MGM Grand in Vegas, surely one of the world's more vulgar pleasure domes, their one major success was a horror movie, Michael Crichton's Westworld, in which a disintegrating Yul Brynner, dressed in black and looking like a nightmare revenant from the Magnificent Seven, intones again and again, "Draw, draw, draw." They draw and lose. Yul is pretty fast, even with his circuits showing. Is this, you ask me, any way to run a railroad? My own answer is no. But the failure of so many films released by the majors seems more explicable to me than the failure of so many of the horror films released by what Variety calls the indies. At this writing, 3 of my novels have been released as films: Carrie, United Artists, theatrical, 1976, Salem's Lot, Warner's, television, 1979, and The Shining, Warner's, theatrical, 1980. And in all 3 cases, I feel that I have been fairly treated. And yet the clearest emotion in my mind is not pleasure, but a mental sigh of relief. When dealing with the American cinema, you feel like you won if you just broke even. Once you've seen the film industry's workings from the inside, you realize that it is a creative nightmare. It becomes difficult to understand how anything of quality, an Alien, a Place in the Sun, a Breaking Away, can be made. As in the Army, the first rule of studio filmmaking is CYA, cover your ass. On any critical decision, it is well to consult at least 6 people, so that someone else's butt will go up in that fabled sling if the film drops dead and $20 million goes swirling down the toilet. And if your butt must go up, it then becomes possible to make sure it doesn't go up alone. There are, of course, filmmakers who either don't know this kind of fear or whose particular visions are so clear and fierce that such fear of failure never becomes a factor in the equation. Brian De Palma comes to mind, and Francis Coppola, who teetered on the edge of being fired from the Godfather shoot for months and yet persisted in his own particular vision of the film, Sam Peckinpah, Don Siegel, Steven Spielberg. Compare, for instance, the single and unified vision which powers Spielberg's Jaws to the sequel, which was produced by a committee and directed by the unfortunate Jeannot Schwark, who was brought in from the bullpen in the late innings to mop up and who deserved better. This factor of vision is so real and apparent that even when a director such as Stanley Kubrick makes such a maddening, perverse, and disappointing film as The Shining, it somehow retains a brilliance that is inarguable. It is simply there. The real danger inherent in studio films is mediocrity. A clinker like Myra Breckinridge has its own horrid fascination. It is like watching slow-motion footage of a head-on collision between a Cadillac and a Lincoln Continental. But what are we to make of films like Nightwing, Capricorn One, Players, or The Cassandra Crossing? These are not bad films. Not the way that Robot Monster or Teenage Monster are bad, certainly, but they are mediocre. They're blah. You leave the theater after one of these films with no taste in your mouth but the popcorn you ate. They are films where, halfway through the second reel, you begin wishing for a cigarette. As the cost of production balloons up and up, the risks of going for all of it become greater and greater, and even a Roger Maris looked pretty stupid when he was badly fooled, totally overswung the ball, and fell on his ass. The same obtains in films, and I would predict, with some hesitation because the film industry is such a crazy place, that we will never again see such a colossal risk as the one Coppola took with Apocalypse Now, or the one Cimino was allowed to take with Heaven's Gate. If anyone tries, that dry, dusty snapping sound you'll hear coming from the West Coast will be the accountants of every major studio out there snapping the corporate checkbooks closed. But the indies? What about the indies? There is less to lose here, certainly. In fact, Chris Steinbrenner, an amusing guy and an astute follower of the films, likes to call many of these flicks backyard movies. By his definition, The Horror of Party Beach was a backyard film. So were The Flesh Eaters and Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Night of the Living Dead, which was made by an existing film company with access to TV studio facilities in Pittsburgh, doesn't qualify as backyard. It's a good term for those films made by amateurs, gifted or otherwise, on a shoestring budget, with no major distribution guaranteed. These films are the much more expensive equivalent of the unsolicited manuscript. These are guys who are shooting with nothing to lose, shooting for the moon. And yet most of these films are just awful. Why? Exploitation, that's why. It was exploitation that caused Lugosi to put finish to his career by creeping around a suburban tract development in his Dracula cape. It was exploitation that prompted the making of Invasion of the Star Creatures and Don't Look in the Basement. And believe me, I didn't have to keep telling myself it was only a movie. I knew what it was. In a word, wretched. After Sex, low-budget movie makers are attracted to horror because it seems to be a genre which is easily exploited. An easy lay, like the sort of girl every guy wanted to date, at least once, in high school. Even good horror can sometimes have a tawdry carnival freak show feel, but it's a feel that can be deceptive. And if it is courtesy of the indies that we have seen the greatest failures, the romance, war surplus, shortwave bubble machine, then it is also courtesy of them that we have seen some of the most unlikely triumphs. The Horror of Party Beach and Night of the Living Dead were made on similar budgets. The difference is George Romero and his vision of what the horror movie is and what the horror movie is supposed to do. In the former, we have the monsters attacking a slumber party in a scene which becomes hilarious. In the latter, we have an old woman peering nearsightedly at a bug on a tree and then munching it up. You hear your mouth trying to laugh and scream at the same time, and that is Romero's remarkable achievement. Werewolf in a Girl's Dormitory and Dementia 13 were made on similar nothing budgets. Here, the difference is Francis Coppola, who created an almost unbearable atmosphere of mounting menace in the latter, a black-and-white, rapidly-shot suspense movie, which was made on location in Ireland for tax purposes. It is, perhaps, too easy to become enamored of bad films as camp. The great success of the Rocky Horror Picture Show may point to nothing so much as the degeneration of the average moviegoer's critical capacity. It might be well to go back to the basics and remember that the difference between bad movies and good, or between bad art, or non-art, and good or great art, is talent, and the inventive utilization of that talent. The worst movie sends its own message, which is simply to stay away from other movies done by these people. If you have seen one film by Wes Craven, for instance, it is safe enough, I think, to skip the others. The genre labors under enough critical disapproval and outright dislike. One need not make a bad situation worse by underwriting films of porno violence and those which want to plunder our pocketbooks and no more. And there is no need to do it, because even in the movies there is no real price tag on quality. Not when Brian De Palma found it possible to make a fine, scary film like Sisters for something like $800,000. The reason for seeing bad movies, I suppose, is that you don't know it's going to be bad until you've seen it for yourself. As previously pointed out, most movie critics cannot be trusted here. Pauline Kael writes well, and Jean Shalit demonstrates a certain rather tiresome surface wit. But when these two and other critics go to see a horror movie, They don't know what they are seeing. The one exception is Judith Crist, who seems to genuinely like horror movies and who is often able to look past a Poverty Row budget to whatever is working there. I've always wondered what she made of Night of the Living Dead. The true fan does. He or she has developed his or her basis for comparison over a long and sometimes painful span of time. The real movie freak is as much an appreciator as the regular visitor to art galleries or museums, and this basis for comparison is the bedrock upon whatever theses or points of view he or she may develop must stand. For the horror fan, films such as Exorcist II form the setting for the occasional bright gemstone that is discovered in the darkness of a sleazy second-run movie house, Kirby McCauley's Rituals, or my own low-budget favorite, Tourist Trap. You don't appreciate cream unless you've drunk a lot of milk, and maybe you don't even appreciate milk unless you've drunk some that's gone sour. Bad films may sometimes be amusing, sometimes even successful, but their only real usefulness is to form that basis of comparison, to define positive values in terms of their own negative charm. They show us what to look for because it is missing in themselves. After that has been determined, it becomes, I think, actively dangerous to hold on to these bad films, and they must be discarded.